This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Dramatic footage is coming out of Norway, where there's heavy flooding after a storm in the country's southwest. Record downpours have caused extensive damage in what's being described as the worst flooding in 200 years.
The skies above Cumbria have cleared, but the legacy of Storm Desmond lives on. I'm above the city of Carlisle, and the sheer scale and depth of the floods is extraordinary. This isn't only affecting the people who live here, it's having a huge impact on transport. The major rail link through here has been cut. And this is a place, bear in mind, that was just given 5 years ago a new £38 million flood defence scheme.
The violence and the volume of the floodwater have taken everyone by surprise.
It's particularly devastating because it's the third time in a very short period of time that it's happened. It's really dreadfully, dreadfully upsetting.
David Shookman, BBC News in Cumbria.
The heaviest rains in over a century, sending a wave of floods across southern India. At least 180 people have died in the disaster in the state of Tamil Nadu. More than 200,000 people have fled from their homes. In the capital city, Chennai, thousands of factories are shut down. The power's cut, schools are closed, and the airport is paralyzed. India grapples with monsoon flooding every year. But Reuters' Douglas Busfine says Prime Minister Narendra Modi has blamed this particular crisis on global warming.
That was a remark he made on returning from the climate summit in Paris. And it's certainly the case that the Indian government has recognized that climate change is a challenge to its own management of cities, its own ability to respond to disasters. This is definitely on the government's agenda.
More than twice as much rain has fallen on Tamil Nadu in the last 24 hours as the entire December average. Weather forecasters say the downpour is set to continue for at least another day.
Evacuations ongoing as rising rivers and creeks force people out of their homes in Portland this morning. Monday was the wettest day in Portland ever, leading to rescues and washed out roads. Don Champion has the latest.
Extreme rainfall events are cropping up around the world. In England, once-in-a-thousand-year floods have repeated. I think it's three times now in 5 years. Records are falling in many countries. In a warmer world, we've gained 7% more water vapor in the atmosphere. It has to come down somewhere. A few weeks ago, our guest David Wasdell suggested the outcome of our current path of emissions would eventually be a world at least 8 degrees centigrade hotter on average, maybe more. Some questioned that. This week, the University of Edinburgh released a paper echoing Wasdell's climate. 8 degrees is possible, according to Professor Roy Thompson, as published in the Transactions of the Royal Society of Edinburgh. Climate change does not occur in a steady economy or a peaceful time. This fall, we saw in Paris how terrorism empowered politicians to ban climate action in the name of public safety. The terrorists knew they were attacking before the world flooded in for the COP21 climate talks. They succeeded in disrupting the essential public voice. But in this show, we asked two different questions. Will the fossil-based economy collapse, just as extreme weather events punish property and infrastructure? What if we are too broke to rebuild or cope? There's a blog for that. It's the Economic Collapse blog with millions of readers. We'll look at fresh warnings of a new depression, how it's forming, with blogger Michael T. Snyder. Then, believe it or not, there are darker things to consider. If climate disrupts agriculture as expected and already happening, social violence and wars may become worse. Our guest Professor Tim Snyder explains why climate change may open the door to more mass murder. It needs to be said, and he said it in the New York Times. We'll talk with Tim Snyder. Off we go now with the black clouds hanging over economies around the world. Since the financial crash of 2007-2008, we've all been a bit nervous about our jobs and the economy. Lately, the warning signs are flashing again, despite trillions of dollars, euros, and pounds given to the banks. Maybe the system is just plain bankrupt and ready to collapse. Blogger Michael T. Snyder runs a blog called The Economic Collapse. It's hugely popular. His warning signs are spread around the internet. Michael is young, a professed Christian, now a novelist, and too often scarily ahead of the mainstream news. Michael, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex. Thank you so much for inviting me to be on today.
I check your blog about twice a week. Do you know how many readers you have?
I do. The Economic Collapse blog has been running since 2009, and at this point, we average well over a million page views per month, month after month after month. Yeah, it's really exciting that so many people from all over the world come and visit the website. But then, of course, as you mentioned, my articles are republished on dozens of other websites all over the world, some much more prominent than my own, where they're seen countless more times each month. So it absolutely amazes me that someone just as myself, an ordinary guy living in the middle of nowhere in the mountains of Idaho, can literally impact people all over the world.
Yeah, I have read several of your articles on Zero Hedge, one of the biggest financial blogs there is, so you definitely are getting out there. Michael, when did you realize the financial system was unstable? And I guess you've told us when you started the Economic Collapse blog. It's been a few years now.
It has been. You know, some of your listeners may not be familiar with me, but I was actually once an attorney. I went to law school at the University of Florida Law School down in Gainesville, Florida, and I graduated from there with a law degree and an LLM. And once I left there, I went back to my old stomping grounds up in the D.C. area, and I actually worked as an attorney right in the heart of Washington, D.C. for a number of years. And so I was working there for quite some time, right down on K Street, kind of where, you know, if you watch television shows or movies about Washington, D.C., you know, K Street's where all the lawyers are, where all the lobbyists are. It doesn't necessarily have the greatest reputation in the world, but I was there. I was just another of the mindless drones that march into Washington, D.C. every day, trying to make a living, trying to make a paycheck, and so that's what I was doing. But at the time, I was becoming increasingly distressed about the direction of our country, about the corruption I saw all around me, about our economic situation. And so the 2008 crash approached. I warned family and friends. In fact, I remember sitting on the sofa when we went up to visit my wife's parents up in Canada and sitting there and sitting on their sofa and telling them in the summer of 2008 a great financial crash was imminent. And, of course, we all know what happened later that year. And so, you know, I was very, very disturbed about that. But it wasn't until late 2009, end of 2009, about this time of the year, that I started the Economic Collapse blog. And it really took off because people, at the time, millions of people had been losing their jobs. Millions of people had been losing their homes. And people were confused because they knew they weren't getting the truth from the mainstream media. They didn't understand what was happening to them, and they were looking for real answers. And so websites such as mine have really taken off. And ever since then, the audience has continued to grow. And like I said today, we've got a very, very large audience, and I'm very thankful for that.
For a while there recently, the whole media choir was singing about the recovery. And you seemed like the odd man out, but now I've read on your blog and elsewhere major banks and billionaires admit we are perched on the edge of another downturn. Who are some of the big-name institutions or well-known business icons who are now warning us?
Yeah, well, just the other day, first of all, J.P. Morgan Chase came out, and they issued a report which said that the possibility of a recession within the next 3 years is 76%, the probability of recession within the next 3 years. But Citigroup was even more pessimistic than J.P. Morgan Chase. Researchers at Citigroup recently released a report where they declared there was a 65% chance that the U.S. economy will plunge into recession by the end of next year, in 2016.
All right. Now, Michael, you're kind of famous for your lists of signs that things are about to fall apart. Could you read us one of your top 10 warning lists?
Yeah, and this one will kind of go along with what I was just talking about. in that right now so many of the exact same patterns and signs that we witnessed right before the great crash of 2008 are happening again right in front of our eyes. For example, global GDP growth has gone negative for the first time since 2009, the last financial crisis. Corporate earnings growth has turned negative. That's something we saw right before the last financial crisis. S&P 500 net profit margins are steeply declining. And why is that important? Well, since 1973, there has only been one 60 basis point decline in S&P 500 net profit margins that didn't lead to a recession. So this is a leading indicator. This is something we tend to watch for, something that would happen before a recession. You know, something else we expect to see before a recession is for global trade to, for a big downturn in global trade. This is something that happened before the last crisis. It's happening now. The biggest bank in the Western world, HSBC, recently came out and said global trade as a whole on a dollarized basis is down 8.4% for the whole world for the year so far. And then we just learned that in October, U.S. imports of goods declined by 6.6% on a year-over-year basis. Kind of surprising because this time of the year, normally we're importing all kinds of stuff to fill up our stores for the busy holiday season, but our imports are down 6.6% for the month of October. Then our exports are down even more. And if you remember Barack Obama, he came out and he said, I'm going to increase U.S. exports. It's going to create more jobs for American workers, blah, blah, blah. But instead, exports are declining. In October, U.S. exports of goods were down 10.4% on a year-over-year basis. These are exactly what we would expect to see before a recession or as we're entering a recession. Also look at manufacturing. U.S. manufacturing is contracting at the fastest pace that we have seen since the last recession. Corporate debt defaults. Corporate debt defaults have risen to the highest level that we've seen since the last recession. We've got all this corporate debt going bad. Corporations getting into trouble. They can't pay their debts. They can't service their debts. Huge problem. This is something that we also saw the last time around. Also, you know, as we entered the last crisis, holiday sales went negative. Well, for the very first time since the last recession, credit card numbers show that holiday sales have gone negative. You know, we've read all this information about potentially a weak holiday season as consumers are stressed. Consumers don't have the same kind of money to spend. That's another problem. So all these things are adding up. Another thing that I watch that I'm concerned about is the velocity of money, and perhaps I should explain that for a moment. When an economy is working efficiently, when times are good, when people are feeling good about things, money tends to flow through the system pretty easily and smoothly. So I buy something from you, you buy something from someone else. The velocity of money tends to go pretty well. But when things start getting hard, when people don't have money, when credit's not flowing smoothly, when people get fearful, they tend to start holding on to their money, the velocity of money slows down. And so what we've seen during every single recession in the post-World War II era, the velocity of money has dropped, and that makes perfect sense for all the reasons why I just explained. Well, a funny thing happened with the last recession. During the last recession, 2008-2009, the velocity of money dropped dramatically, exactly what we would expect. Then the recession ended, and the velocity of money ticked up just slightly, but then it started going down again, and it kept going down and down and down all throughout the supposed economic recovery, and just recently it dropped to the lowest level ever recorded. And so that's an indication of an economy that is very, very deeply troubled. And, of course, this is not just a U.S. thing. We're seeing globally what we're seeing, some very troubling signs. We're seeing the price of oil. If you remember, right before the stock market crash of 2008, we saw the price of oil go up to about $140 a barrel, drop dramatically to beneath $40 a barrel. It was the biggest oil crash in all of history. Well, we've seen a similar thing happen here in just in recent times. In 2014, late 2014, the price of oil really crashed. It had been over $100 a barrel at one point, crashed dramatically, but then it stabilized for a little while. But now it's crashing again, and just this week it fell below $38 a barrel for the very first time since 2009, since the last financial crisis and the last recession. You know, also looking at commodities, Before the great financial crash of 2008, we saw a crash in the price of commodities. I'm talking about things like iron ore, copper, lead, tin, aluminum, things of that nature. Well, right now we're seeing the price of commodities crash again. In fact, the Bloomberg Commodity Index just hit a 16-year low. This is exactly what we would expect to see if a major financial crash was imminent. Another thing I watch very, very closely is junk bonds. You know, when there's financial trouble, usually we start to see it play out in at the edges. Kind of, you know, junk bonds, a lot of people may get thrown off by that term, but it's just junk bonds are considered to be a little bit riskier, so they have a higher rate of return, and therefore corporations that are maybe not as stable, a little bit riskier. Well, that's where we start to see the trouble erupt when financial trouble starts to come. And so in 2008, junk bonds crashed before stocks did. And if it was going to happen again, we would expect to see it start to happen again. Well, a high-yield bond ETF that I watch very, very closely, known as JNK, I've been waiting for it to hit the psychologically important 35 level and drop below that. And it hasn't happened since 2009, but it happened just this week. Just this week, JNK hit 35, went below 35, dropped down to 34.44 at one point. But that's a huge red flag that big trouble is coming for stocks. And then on top of everything else, back in 2008, we started to see other global stock markets start to collapse before U.S. stocks did. And right now, in 2015, of the 93 largest stock market indexes in the entire world, 47 of them, slightly more than half, are not only just down, but 47 of them have plunged at least 10% year-to-date. Some of them down like 40 or 50%. So already we've seen global stock market crashes all over the world. It's just the U.S. hasn't felt the full force of this yet. And so, you know, Americans are saying, well, maybe everything's going to be okay. But everything that we're seeing is playing out just like we saw in 2008. And everything that we would expect to see right before a major financial crash here in the United States, it's playing out in textbook fashion, Alex.
Yeah, we really have to look in other places of the world, too. We're not just an island in North America or Europe. I'm thinking about Brazil. That was touted as being one of the big powerhouses, the new industrial thing. They had their energy going. Goldman Sachs just came out this month and said they're in an outright depression. There's no way to hide it. Argentina's a mess. We could go on, and many places of the world, they're already in their recession, if not depression, wouldn't you say?
Oh, I completely agree. This is something I started writing back in the summer. And then, like, as you mentioned, when Goldman Sachs came out and said, well, you know, Brazil's really, you know, you might as well call it a depression, what's happening down there. And it's true. They plunged into this horrible recession. They're, if I recall correctly, the sixth largest economy on the entire planet. So Brazil's a really big deal. But what happened was Brazil's considered to be one of these emerging markets. And something we saw before the 2008 crisis was the U.S. dollar surged, and this created all kinds of problems in emerging markets, and it's happening again. And why the U.S. dollar surging is such a big problem was during the quantitative easing era, during the easy money, when the Federal Reserve was creating all this easy money and money was flowing at super low interest rates all over the world, a lot of this hot money flowed into emerging markets. So we saw this huge binge by governments in emerging markets, big corporations in emerging markets. They gorged on debt. Much of it was denominated in U.S. dollars. And so now that the U.S. dollar has really surged in recent months, this is really hurting them because it takes much more of their own local currencies to service and pay back these debts. Meanwhile, the oil and other commodities that they export, they're getting less dollars for, less money for. So it's this double whammy, which is really hitting emerging markets like Brazil really hard. So, you know, Brazil's already in recession. Some are calling it depression. Canada is in recession. Russia's in recession. Japan is in recession. And all over the world, we're seeing recessions in emerging markets. We're seeing stock market collapses in emerging markets. Huge problems all over the planet. But, you know, as Americans, we're so focused on this country, we don't realize the intensity of the carnage that we're already seeing all over the world.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Michael T. Snyder, owner of the Economic Collapse blog. Okay, so do you think, Michael, that we'll wake up one day to find the stock market on the floor and the banks closed? Or will the economy fall apart bit by bit over time?
Well, I've always said that I have a little bit of a different perspective on this, that I believe our economic collapse is something that has been happening, is happening right now, and is going to continue to happen and will accelerate in the future. And yes, there will be big events, but a lot of people who write about the economic collapse, they kind of write about it like it's some big hyped up event that will happen in a day or a week or a month, and then it'll be over, and then we'll pick up the pieces. Well, I don't see it that way. I see it as a crisis which is ongoing and is going to intensify. So, yeah, I do believe that we're going to see a dramatic stock market crash like we saw in 2008, and that there will be ups and downs, but that, you know, our financial markets are going to really fall, and they're not going to get back up. You know, although there'll be moments of hope and, you know, moments when things seem like they're getting better, but we are going to see a complete and total kind of final implosion of our current financial system, I believe. And I believe that we will see banks fail, financial institutions fail, two big failed banks actually fail. And, of course, last time around in 2008, we were told, oh, too big to fail, it's a huge problem. Our politicians said, we're going to fix this. Well, did they fix it? Of course not. In fact, since that time, the last crisis, the two big to fail banks, I'm talking about banks like Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, Citigroup, et cetera, since the last financial crisis, collectively, the two big to fail banks have gotten 40% larger. Meanwhile, 1,400 smaller banks have totally gone out of existence. So the problem of too big to fail is now bigger than ever. And during this time, instead of learning their lesson, these too big to fail banks have become even more reckless, even more insane. You know, if you want to talk about these derivatives, where five of these too big to fail banks have exposure to derivatives, that's in the tens of trillions of dollars. And yet the biggest one of them, J.P. Morgan Chase, has assets of about $2.6 trillion. And so, you know, these big banks have turned Wall Street into the biggest casino in the history of the world. They've been insanely reckless. Maybe they're counting on the fact that the U.S. government will somehow bail them out, you know, once things spiral out of control. But globally, this derivatives bubble is somewhere in the neighborhood of $600 trillion, according to the Bank for International Settlements. And so when this worldwide derivatives bubble finally bursts, there's not going to be enough money in the entire world to clean up this mess.
I know that you've seen this too. Some bloggers seem to take joy in things falling apart, and they tell us to buy lots of guns to shoot one another, maybe over the last can of food. I don't find that in your work. In fact, you tell us we need more love. How do you get to that space reporting the awful things that you do?
Yeah. You know, a lot of people say, well, Michael, you write about some really hard things. You must be just real negative, depressed person all the time. But that's not true at all. In fact, my wife and I seek to live in a constant state of shalom, which is the Hebrew word for peace. You know, so we don't live in fear. In fact, I sleep extremely good at night. But I don't think it does any good for us to stick our heads in the sand and ignore the problems that are happening, what's happening on the horizon. So I do believe that we are coming up on the worst times. By the time everything is said and done, I believe we're going to see the worst times that America has ever seen, even greater than the Great Depression of the 1930s, any other time you want to name. I believe that by the time we get to the end of the road, and it's going to take a while to get there, by the time everything plays out, things are going to be really bad. So I do advocate preparation. I mean, you know, my wife and I ourselves, we store up food and supplies, and we believe in precious metals and all that. But on the other hand, I also believe that when times are the darkest, that's when the greatest heroes are needed. And if you look back through history, and people that we admire, who are the great heroes that we admire? Well, they rose up during times of great challenge, of great stress, of great crisis. So my wife and I are actually looking forward to the future. We believe that the greatest chapters of our lives are still ahead. Yeah, conditions are going to be different from what they are today. Our world is becoming increasingly unstable. Things are going to change. Our lifestyles are going to change. And yet the greatest opportunities to do good, to make a difference, to, you know, do things that are meaningful and purposeful are ahead of us. So we are really excited about what's coming up. But, yeah, things are going to be very, very different in this country, without a doubt.
I know you've published a novel called The Beginning of the End. What are you trying to do with that book?
Well, what I wanted to do was paint a picture. Because so many people, you know, they learn about some of these things, and they're like, about what's happening, and they're like, okay, what is my life going to look like? What are we facing? What are we going to be dealing with? And then on the other hand, people really like to be entertained. In our society today, we're addicted to entertainment. The average American watches 293 minutes of television a day. We love our movies, our DVDs, our video games, all the rest of it. You know, so people love a good story. So what I wanted to do was create a compelling and very entertaining story, and that's what this is, The Beginning of the End. It's a mystery slash thriller set in the near future in America. And it's got there's a ex-CIA agent in there, there's a prepper in there, there's a female news reporter, and all their lives end up intersecting in some very interesting ways. And so it's a very interesting story. Some people that have read it said, I got the book, I read it in 48 hours, I couldn't put it down. And so people really enjoy it, but it's a book with a purpose. So what I've done in every chapter, I've tried to incorporate truth bombs. I've tried to communicate so much of what I've learned in my research over the years and really try to paint a picture of what I believe is coming to this country, what things are going to look like as the economy collapses, and so many of the other things I believe are coming, I try to incorporate into this work. So people are being entertained, but at the same time, they're being informed. And it's the kind of thing you can give to a friend, a family member, a coworker, and say, hey, read, you know, check out this great book. But it can also serve to wake them up at the same time.
You know, I worry about how little prepared, even mentally, my fellow citizens seem to be. It's like people want to party right up to the moment the car goes off the cliff. Michael, what do you think softens us up? Is it the media? Is it corrupt government? To big corporations? What makes us so blind to the events that you are reporting every week in the Economic Collapse blog?
Well, that's a really great question, Alex, and you're right, people are prepared. In fact, we haven't learned our lesson from the last time around. About 62% of all Americans are living paycheck to paycheck, and most people seem to think happy days are ahead of us. Well, I think kind of what I touched on earlier, where it really is this giant propaganda matrix that we're all plugged into, that we all greatly underestimate the impact that it has on all of our lives. And so, as I mentioned just earlier, the average American does, this is according to the Washington Post, the average American watches 293 minutes of television a day. That's almost 5 hours. And another study found when you add everything together, television and movies and DVDs and the radio and, you know, our smartphones and, you know, video games and everything else, the average American is plugged into some form of media for an average of 10 hours a day. And now, who controls all that? Who's giving us the messages we're constantly getting through all this? Well, at the very top, all of this media, more than 90% of it, is controlled by just six gigantic media corporations, which in turn, of course, are owned by the elite of the world. And so they really do set the agenda for what we think about, what we talk about with our family members at the dinner table, at school, at work, around the water cooler, our interactions with each other. So much of what they're based on is a sporting event we just saw, or a television show that we saw, you know, we're watching last night, or something that came up on the news. You know, we talk about the things that were fed through this propaganda matrix, and they really set the agenda for what we think about, what we consider to be important. If the mainstream media is not talking about it, totally ignoring it, well, then it must not be meaningful. It must not be important. So one of the things I really try to get people to do is wake up and understand that this gigantic behemoth, which is called the mainstream media, or I call it the propaganda matrix, it has a gigantic amount of impact over all of our lives.
Yeah, we're almost losing ourselves to this shadow that follows us everywhere we go.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. The other concern I have, Michael Snyder, is coming from the weekly content of my own radio show, we're facing big problems. You can call it whatever you want, but the weather's weird. It's distorted. As we speak, there's been hardly any snow in the northern states, at least in the east. Parts of the south and west coast are drowning in extreme rainfall events. There's droughts, floods around the world. If that keeps going, and governments and just plain people will go broke trying to rebuild over and over. And if your blog is right and the system goes bankrupt first, we won't be able to fix anything. What are your thoughts?
Oh, I agree. You know, we're having huge problems with our infrastructure. You know, up in the state of Michigan, they've actually, some rural roads have actually been, they used to be paved roads, but they've transitioned those back to gravel roads because they're cheaper to maintain, because there's not enough money to maintain our infrastructure. You know, different reports that come out kind of on a yearly basis give extremely low grades to our infrastructure. We're seeing bridges fail all over the country. We've got a huge crisis with our bridges, but it's our roads, it's our airports, it's, you know, our sewer systems are aging and are breaking down, you know, and the money simply isn't there to maintain them and keep them up as they should. So we're seeing infrastructure all over the country break down. At the same time, we're seeing increasing natural disasters. We're seeing in Oklahoma, they've already set a brand new record for the number of earthquakes in a year in Oklahoma, in the central part of the country. You know, we're seeing flooding, you know, right now out in Portland, horrible flooding, rains coming in. Someone just sent me an email today about the flooding out there. Of course, we had the flooding out in South Carolina earlier this year associated with Hurricane Joaquin. The governor of the state said that was a 1,000-year storm. That, you know, the areas of Earth, they got the amount of rain not seen in 1,000 years. Out in California, the drought has been so bad, but then a huge storm came in, caused tremendous flooding and mudslides. Mud came across major highways, you know, and then down in Texas, they've also had horrible flooding, you know, the remnants of Hurricane Patricia down there. So we had all the flooding and then the fires, you know, according to the National Interagency Fire Center, according to them, we have now set a brand new record for the number of acres burned by fire for a year. In any year in U.S. history, this was the worst year for the number of acres burned by wildfires in all of U.S. history. And I know it was really bad because a fire came to within about 10 miles of my home out here in the mountains of Idaho. And so, yeah, we're seeing these natural disasters, all these things increase and become destructive. And then, you know, we're really struggling to rebuild. You know, down in New Orleans, they're still struggling to rebuild, you know, almost a decade after Hurricane Katrina. So it is a major problem. And as the economy gets worse and as government funding dries up a lot more than it is now, this trend and what we're seeing is only going to intensify.
So, Michael Snyder, are we just spectators to a great unwinding that has to happen, or should we fight trying to save the system?
Well, for years, I've been advocating for things that we could do. You know, we needed to do something about Wall Street. We needed to do something about derivatives. We needed to do something about the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is really at the core of our debt-based financial system, which is and central banking all over the world, of course, causing huge problems, and we're seeing global debt at records we've never seen before. You know, something should have been done. Our system should have been fundamentally reformed after the last crisis. We should have learned our lessons, and so there were things that myself and other people were advocating as potential solutions, but they were totally ignored. Instead, the powers that be patched the system together. They went on with business as usual. Our long-term problems continue to get even worse. So at this point, we're so close, and I believe the next crisis has already started. It's unfolding. So I don't believe it's going to be averted. I don't believe there's any hope for a political solution. That